Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's Saturday, February 15th, 2014, and welcome to episode 68 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Find my way back to Oz.
The RCR is a podcast about retrocomputer news, nostalgia, and collecting. We retrocompute, therefore we are. I'm Earl Evans, and I'm hosting today. And with me on the podcast, I've got some great folks here. Joining us for the first time as a regular co-host is Dr. Stephen Weirich. Dr. Steve, how you doing?
Very good. How are you all today?
Good. It's great that you can join in. You've been on the host roster for a little while now, but our schedule has been dancing around. We were hoping we could avoid you indefinitely, but it just couldn't turn out that way. So
finally hit the target, yes.
That's right. Good to have you on the show. Also is Paul. Paul Hagstrom. How you doing there, Paul?
I'm doing all right. The snow here seems to be melting a little.
Paul, where do you hail from?
Oh, well, I started out more or less in Minnesota, so the snow isn't that scary to me, but it's unusual to have this much in Boston.
Yep, it's been snowing all over the place. A week and a half back, we had a foot of snow here in Portland, and the city just turned into an ice cube. School shut down, the road shut down, and my family lives on a hill, so when it snows, you can get off the hill if you want to go real fast and maybe not steer, but in terms of getting back on the hill, that's just not going to happen unless you're an Eskimo. So we were house locked for a few days. Luckily, we had lots of food and good company. And somewhere where it's not snowing because it's summer, Michael Mulhern, co-host from Down Under. How you doing, Michael?
Good morning, Earl. Doing quite well. Got quite a bit of warm snow here in Sydney at the moment, just lots of drizzling rain, but that's a good thing to have at this time of year.
And I want to particularly thank Michael for being here real early. Being in Australia, the time zone thing is a challenge when we work around when we're going to record. And today, Michael drew the short straw, and it's quite early on his side. So, Michael, we appreciate the dedication there to the RCR. I don't know if I'd have done that.
8 bits rule forever.
Excellent. So today's host topic. A couple days ago, Thursday evening, I went to the local Commodore Computer Club meeting, and there are actually a couple of Commodore clubs in Portland, as I've mentioned before. And the one Commodore club here that meets in Beaverton, Oregon, has changed its agenda now. Rather than being presentation-oriented, it is project-oriented. People bring their projects, and they tear them apart, and other people help. And we had some really fascinating stuff going on with the soldering irons there a couple nights ago, including I took my pet, 2001, because I had some stubborn keys, and we tore the thing apart, and I cleaned up the keyboard with the help of my daughter, who came along, and put it all back together, and the keyboard now is brand spanking new. I mean, it just feels wonderful, and it got me thinking, lots of folks out there repair these retro computers, and as they get older, it's going to be more of a reality that if we want to keep running these things, we won't be able to just go to eBay forever and buy them. And anyway, it's kind of fun to roll up your sleeves. So I thought, what items tools, techniques, resources? Just what's your go-to kind of resources when you're repairing vintage computers? And Michael, I see you'd put some notes in here. Why don't you start us around the square table?
Well, why not? I, like many users, was a little bit hesitant the first time I had to go in and do a repair, but I think the best piece of advice I can give anyone is to just have some confidence to get in there. Yes, you can do it. Apart from the web for various teardowns, YouTube, it's got great information and a video from other people who are boldly going where no one's gone before. That's really, just be confident. Slow, steady, big, clear workspace to work from, take lots of photos. We've got digital cameras. You've got your phone. Take lots of pictures. It's going to help when you want to put it back together.
It would also help, I think. The good thing about taking pictures, too, is that when the next person is searching on the web, if you make them available, you can help them, you know, sort of see what's coming when they open the thing up.
Yeah, I've done that with that's been one of the intentions of taking photos when I've been working on my projects, but I suppose it's something I should really get them up there onto the blog, even just in the most basic format. As you're right, now people are looking to sort of see, that's what it looks like inside. That's not too hard. But Earl's touched on it in the past. Another good piece of equipment to have is variable temperature soldering iron. You can just use your $20 soldering stick from the local electronic shop or Walmart, they even sell them, but a variable temperature soldering iron so that you can just work carefully through with what you're doing. Just grab something else, something old, just to practice desoldering and soldering in a component before you even start on your heritage item from days of yore. But the important thing is just to be confident and just to take it slowly. You will get there.
Yeah, I have not yet taken time to try to do any repair work on a computer, but I did get to build a couple of Heathkit shortwave radios back in the 70s, and the experience with that was invaluable with, that confidence of being able to do something if I wanted to repair it. And the trick, of course, with soldering is be well-lighted place so you can see what you're doing, and you can make sure that you can see if you have any bridges between two places that don't need to be bridged, connecting electrically what's not supposed to be.
I find it fascinating when you talk about confidence. I don't tend to be confident when it comes to this kind of stuff. And I think Michael hit it right on the head. I think you do have to believe that you can do it. It's interesting. I was going through this book called Make Electronics. It's a tutorial. And one of the things they have you do is buy some parts that you're going to destroy during the first few lessons in the book. You actually turn up the voltage on an LED until it smokes before your eyes. And I think the purpose is to let you know that, A, you can do it. B, occasionally when you're doing this stuff, things are going to go wrong, but that's okay. It's not the end of the world. Usually you can fix what you broke. I had another 386 motherboard that had a real-time clock chip on it. No battery. The battery is inside the chip, so you have to file into the top of the chip, believe it or not, so that you can then cut the little battery lead inside the chip substrate and then attach an external power source. And I thought, there's no way I'm going to be able to do this. But I went to the YouTubes. I went to the resources that were on the web, one of which was Tez's website, the classiccomputers.nz, I think it is. And I got it done. I mean, it actually worked. So you can do it.
And one of the advantages of working on the older computers is that the technology for assembly was just simpler back in the day. So stuff from the 1970s and early 80s, I mean, if I was going to try to take apart this MacBook Pro I'm working on right now, or I'm doing this recording on right now, I don't think it'd be possible for the kind of tools I have in my hand to do much with the motherboard. But, you know, the older computers had things soldered onto the motherboard. You could see where the points were. and I could see that you could clean off the points, take a part out, put another one, and solder it again.
And a lot of the earlier computers, they just had straight-through connectors on the motherboards, not multiple layers, so it was a lot simpler day.
Hmm.
Yeah, one of the things... So, the repairs that I've done are sort of, or I guess to the extent that I have done any repairs, they're sort of a result of having that confidence. But it is, a lot of these things are sort of irreplaceable, you know. So it does seem like a very good idea to find a junk board to practice on first, you know. Confidence to a point, but some of the things do need to care needs to be taken with some of them. But on the other hand, it really does seem like before you've ever tried to solder something, it seems like a very scary and near impossible task. And once you do it, once you get the hang of it, it is fairly natural.
There's a gentleman who has a electronics engineering blog. I think they call it the EEV blog. And if you go to YouTube, you can find a series of three videos he did on how to solder. And I strongly recommend those videos for anyone who's getting into electronics or retro computer repair or that kind of thing, because he really goes through the techniques and the logistics of it. And another thing that Michael put in the show notes here, spare computers for parts. One of the things I've been trying to do as I right-size my collection is get rid of things that I'm not going to invest in or feel like I'm going to invest my time in into the future, but get spares of things that I think will remain a part of my core collection. Because that way, if the worst happens, I know that I've got either something I can draw parts from or a whole spare that I can use.
In case something happens to your production PX8.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's funny you mentioned the PX8 because that outfit in Colorado that was selling them, I bought the one, and it wasn't too much later that I thought, these things aren't going to last forever, so I bought another one. So I got a couple of them, and I feel really good that I have a couple of them, because when the one breaks, then I know that, you know. Also, the other thing... There may not be a local retro computer club in your area. I think Portland's kind of unique that we've got a couple of them here. But it's likely with the rise of the maker movement that there's a hacker space in your area or somewhere that electronics nerds get together and do electronic stuff. And if that's the case, you might just haul your retro computer there. I mean, I'd go there and check it out first, obviously, but... I think in a lot of cases, they love that stuff. I've noticed this crossover between the maker movement and the old retro computers. One of the local Portland electronics hobbyist groups here, a guy was making a add-on board for his K-Pro. So, yeah, there seems to be a lot of cross-pollinization there.
And, you know, if somebody hasn't done soldering before, if they really think they want to get involved with it, there's... lots of places on the internet that you can go and find simple electronics kits that you can put together. They're meant to be built by people who haven't done much before, and that's a great place to get started. You get a simple $15 kit. I just looked here. There's a place called Maker Shed that has a LED light thing that you can put together. It's got, you know, a small handful of parts on here. It's a small circuit board. Looks like it's about 2 by 2 inches. And, you know, if you spend $15 on something and you mess it up, you haven't lost that much. If you mess up your one-of-a-kind retro computer because you couldn't get it soldered back together again, you're going to be heartbroken. But this is a great thing to practice on, and you get something like this built and you feel confident because, hey, it worked. Then you feel like you got a little bit more ability to work on some of the older stuff that is a little bit less available.
That's a very good point. And, in fact, we went to Radio Shack, and my daughter and I bought one of those proto boards with the solder holes on it.
Yes.
And we just soldered some wires onto it. Not in any particular order, just trying to solder some things onto that board so that we got the hang of it.
Yeah, great way to practice.
It only cost us $3 to do that, plus the solder and the things like that. But One other thing I'd mention, I don't know if we talked about it, but the Vintage Computer Forums, that is a great place to go chat with people about your broken vintage computers. A while back when they had a pet contest doing interesting things with your pet computer, as an adjunct to that, they had the pet veterinary clinic that was open where you could post problems that you were having with your Commodore pet, and they would help you troubleshoot and diagnose it. But the Vintage Computer Forums have subforums for all the various models of computers. So if you're having trouble, you don't know how to diagnose it, there's some great folks over there, and they don't mind at all giving of their time.
So real quick, the keyboard that you fixed on your pet, was this the Pet 2001 with the chiclet keyboard, or was it a regular keyboard one?
It's a regular keyboard one.
Okay.
I don't have the chiclet one. I have the one that came right after that, which is called the -8N. It has the Petsky graphical keys on the sides of the keys, but the keyboard is a standard business size keyboard.
Because I would imagine fixing the chiclet keyboard would be a bit more difficult.
Probably, and probably quite stressful, because those go for a lot of money.
Yes.
The pets with the chiclet keyboard. So I'm almost glad that I don't have one of those, honestly. I mean, it would be fun to have one in my collection, but I think it's one of those computers where the value is getting up to the point where I might be nervous about powering it on. So anyhow, so yeah, that's just, those are great ideas. Thank you, guys.
Just one more to add in there. It doesn't hurt to have some good tools and things along with your soldering iron, so I've always recommended people go to ifixit.com if they don't have a local electronics store near them. Great computer-oriented toolkits and stuff there. And there are lots of electronics stores around that have a good online presence and online stores these days for buying the bits and pieces. So it doesn't cost much to get a good basic toolkit and soldering iron, and there's always bits and pieces around the house that can help. I've had several projects where I've needed to separate the cases of computers, and I found the best tool is actually old gift cards, credit card style gift cards. You just can manage to slide them in and release those catches, because over the years those plastic catches, they're pretty brittle these days, and you just got to be gentle, and this allows you to pop the cases apart. I've even used that for splitting the bottom off off old laptops to get in and remove the bezels. So don't throw away that gift card. Put it in your toolkit.
Not just for breaking into hotel rooms.
No, definitely not.
The iFixit site also is pretty interesting, not just from a like a retro computing perspective, but they do, this is the store adjunct that you mentioned before, but they also do teardowns of you know, many different computers. So if you wanted to see a sort of step-by-step of how to replace the hard drive on your, you know, iMac G4, which is probably just about retro now, right? It'll be there. So, and I think we could contribute to it too, actually, if you wanted to contribute a teardown of your, you know, whatever pet, you could put it in there.
Something else to do with all those photos I've taken and done nothing with.
This is fascinating. I've never been on this iFixit store. This is great.
The other thing, the other connection, just to keep bulldozing ahead without switching topics here, is the if you don't. So there are a lot of sort of specialized tools that it's useful to have for this kind of thing, but that's one advantage of the trying to find a hackerspace or whatever, because often they have kind of like communal tools. So if you don't, you know, if there's something that you need to fix your computer now, but you're not going to, you know, you only have the one and you won't need it after you're done fixing it, it's quite possible that if you do find a little local community like that, there'll be something you can borrow for, you know, an afternoon.
Very good point, because the tools are quite an investment. I mean, they're, you know, a lot of the things, if you get the decent quality stuff, it doesn't come cheap. So finding a group of people, I mean, just at the Thursday night gathering, I wound up having a tool that somebody else didn't have, and vice versa. And as it turns out, both of our repairs would have failed if we didn't have each other's tools. So, nice. That gift card trick, that's a good idea, because those little plastic snaps always just are a nightmare.
Mm-hmm. And it's so sad when they break.
It is, because you know there's no way you can glue them back on. They won't hold. That's all right. Well, so topics. Let's move along. Paul, you found a modern-day retro computer.
Yeah, so this just came to my attention recently, but even more recently it has come to my attention that it isn't all that recent. But that's okay. It's the Maximite. The color Maximite... Where is the BBX? Yeah, well, let me sort of back up. There was a Kickstarter that came to my attention, which is the Maximite BBX, the modern day basic language computer, and the Kickstarter is basically looking for funding to sort of assemble a bunch of these little boxes. So there's sort of like nice cases around a computer that actually had existed prior to the Kickstarter. What it is. It's basically, you know, just made of current components, but it's a computer with BASIC and ROM, and it's, I think it has 128K and can do color and connect to modern equipment. But the idea is that it's works sort of like, and it's Arduino based, I think, but it works sort of like, you know, the old computers did in the 80s.
Definitely
where you just
retro
turn it on.
Inspired.
Yes. Simple. It has a little SD card slot for a floppy drive, and there's some... It actually does have little headers for standard Arduino shields and things like that that you can put on it. So I thought it was sort of interesting just because it is, it is an attempt to make a simple computer, one of these sort of old-style, comprehensible computers. Apart from that... One of the things I was wondering, so I looked at it, and I wasn't sure what to think of it, actually. It's possible to buy the board by itself, and I think there's in the show notes there'll be a link to Jeff Graham's page on the project. One of the things I was wondering was, you know, how this differs from something like, you know, some special, like getting a specially programmed SD card for a Raspberry Pi, you know? I mean, like, is this a sort of a different thing, or is it really just a configuration of something that we could get in a different way? So, do others of you like know more about this?
Well, this uses a PIC32 processor, and you flash in the firmware that you're talking about here, the BASIC and ROM, as it were. I think that makes it more like a retro computer than running an emulator on something like a Raspberry Pi. Because if you've got the Raspberry Pi and it's running Linux, and then under Linux you're running X-Windows, and under X-Windows you're running this emulator, there's a lot of layers of abstraction in between the retro computer that you're ostensibly running and the actual platform that it's running on. Right? In this particular case, there's a lot less. You take the BASIC, you load it onto this PIC chip, and then your computer is running the BASIC natively. You don't have another operating system underneath you. You don't have those layers of abstraction. It really is that computer running and doing its thing. So I think it is more like an old retro computer. Now, you could reprogram it. You could probably, and I wonder if some people have with this Maximite. I wonder if they've put other things on it, like Forth, or you could reprogram the. And one of the other things that I wanted to point out, and you'll probably cover some of these other alternatives to the one that's being sold in the Kickstarter. If you want, you can go to SparkFun and pick up something called a USB 32-bit whacker. And it's a $40 component, which is essentially this PIC32 chip on a development board with breadboard-friendly headers. If you had that and you put in some of the external connectors, like the VGA and the USB and that sort of thing, you could build a computer very similar to that Maximite. And I think that you'd also included some other things on there, didn't you, Paul, about another avenue to pick one of these up?
Oh, well, there was, I think this was, I forget, there was a mailing list that that was mentioning this, and so I followed a link. But it's possible to get, so the Kickstarter itself is for kind of like an assembled thing. So you have a board, but it's inside a plastic case that's being made for it. And the point of the Kickstarter is basically just to, it's like pre-order up until the point where it's sort of economically viable to buy them. But you can get the board by itself without the case at circuitgizmos.com, at least among other places. It is possible to get it cheaper than the Kickstarter reward level if you weren't after the case, but just after the machine itself.
Yeah, it looks like it's $57 over on Circuit Gizmos.
So just to clarify, the Maximite that they're talking about here, it has this BASIC that runs on it. There's some kind of operating system then, so that when you make a BASIC program, you can save it onto your SD card?
Like it's the all old in ROM, just like the good old days.
Yep.
Okay. So if you do that, then you, like you say, you're putting in a different language, you're putting in Forth instead. Is that require a different operating system or just a modification to the same one? Or
I'm only speculating that those things are available.
Okay.
Yeah. It would be something that you would flash onto the device in place. I haven't found a Forth for Earl to play with, but
So if you're flashing it, it's almost like on an old computer pulling out the ROM chip and putting a different ROM chip in it. Okay.
Yeah. I've included a link to the Silicon Chip Magazine March 2011 issue. That's got the article which I would have first seen when this came out.
Okay. That talks all about it.
Hmm.
Yeah. Interesting. Anyway, not retro, but retro in spirit.
Well, it's definitely something that again, it's a good little soldering project. It's as I said, it's retro inspired. Just something different for the folks out there to have a look at.
See, I could sit down with something like this and feel like I could understand it and program it. And people talk about iPads as being a consumption device rather than a creation device, which is an argument that is probably not correct. But really speaking, on my MacBook Pro, it's more of a consumption device as far as programming is concerned. I don't program anything on it. I just use stuff that other people have made. This Maximite is something I feel like you could sit down and I could program this. I could find something to do with it.
Mm. Yeah, and I think actually, we've talked, I think, on a couple of episodes about things like the Raspberry Pi and stuff things that are kind of intended for education and getting into the platform, sort of getting into computer programming and things. And this seems like a much better choice than even the Raspberry Pi. I mean, the Raspberry Pi, it's Linux. it's complicated.
Right.
Whereas this, you really could just start it. And of course, also there's a big difference between the price of the 8-bit computers when they first came out and the price of this thing now. If the kid drops it in the hot chocolate or whatever, you can get another one.
It's even got Arduino headers, and I don't know which Arduino shields it might be compatible with or not, but they break out a lot of the I.O. pins, and from the BASIC language, you can access those I.O. pins and talk to other devices. So it's got some cool I.O. capabilities as well as just being a standalone programmable box that you can write in BASIC and then store on your SD card. So what
is an Arduino header or shield anyway? What does that mean?
So an Arduino is a platform, and there are many specific devices that are compatible with that platform or standard. The headers are a set of standard I/O pins in a standard configuration. Like, imagine card slots on an Apple.
Okay.
That you've got pins at known locations and a known interface, if you will, for plugging something in, right?
Okay.
Same sort of thing. It's like a card slot, and then the shields are boards or devices that fit into those pins and do something. Maybe show you some LEDs, or maybe let you do some inputs to your Arduino, some switches, or gosh, there's all kinds of different plug-in cards for the Arduino, but shield means plug-in card.
Okay, that makes sense then.
Yeah, and that was actually what confused me, why I thought it was an Arduino board. It does seem to be a PIC baseboard with Arduino headers.
Yep. Yeah, it's really cool. I thank you for bringing that up. And also, thank you to John for sending us an email on that very same topic to bring that to our attention. So we'll have links to all of the stuff that we just talked about. And on to Michael and something on the GoTech floppy emulator.
Yeah, I was just having a look at the GoTech floppy emulator to sort of see how I could fit that into any of my projects. Because, you know, the floppy drives, they're starting to get a few years on them. And as I was just coming through, I found an update to the firmware for your GoTech to run ADF files on an Amiga. I popped on over to the website, and what they've done is he's updated the firmware and flashed the new firmware onto the GoTech floppy emulator so as to handle the Amiga ADF files, provided it with a bit of a bootstrap to display the ADF images on the card, and to select from them. And on his webpage, we have here demonstrations of software running on an Amiga 600, state-of-the-art demo. The firmware gives the ability to read the 880 kilobyte ADF files on a FAT32 card. So I thought that was a very creative way of utilizing something which is fairly easily available as a floppy drive substitute. Just plug in your USB key into the front of it. It takes up the same 3.5-inch floppy drive space and form factor. And here's someone who's gone and broken through a barrier that they saw and wrote their own firmware. I was very impressed to see that someone would actually write an alternate firmware for something which is commercially available to solve their specific problem. So again, links in the show notes. So if you're an Amiga aficionado and you're looking to get those ADF files running natively on your hardware, here's a solution for you.
And just to clarify, the ADF is the disk image format. It's the name of the disk image format for the Amiga, right?
Yep, that's right.
Okay.
But this is there were problems with the this particular style of disk image, and this is a way of getting those images read on the GoTech.
Great
that's
solution.
Interesting. Yeah. So I've seen you know, in my perusing of eBay, I've seen these emulators go by, and I look at them every once in a while. Do you have any experience with? I'm talking about the actual, the sort of stock 3.5-inch drive emulator. Do you have any experience with that on the machines it's sort of intended for? Do they work? No.
Well, I haven't done anything okay. Firsthand myself, but it was something I was looking for, because I'm down to my last couple of 3.5-inch drives, and I've just been sort of like shuffling them between PCs, and these days I'm mainly just using the these last drives for imaging floppy disks. My most reliable 3.5-inch drive I currently have hooked up to a Cryoflux USB controller, and I'm using that 3.5-inch drive to actually image all my 400K and 800K Mac disks, rather than fire up any of my 30-year or so old Macs to do that imaging. I do it on a relatively cheap and not quite modern-day 3.5-inch disk. So I was looking for a 3.5-inch disk alternative, and mainly from getting it to put into one of my older machines and just running it using disk images. As we've linked to other devices for machines in the past, and they're purpose-built for a Mac or purpose-built for a Commodore. I was just looking at this one and as a generic 3.5-inch floppy disk replacement. So one of these days it'll be added to my project list, and then someday after that it'll actually go to my active list, and sometime between now and the crack of doom, I might actually have it running.
I have second-hand information, Paul, on this. I've never tried it myself, but there's been chatter on the vintage computer forums and other places about do these things work, and for their intended purpose, the 720K and 1.44 world, apparently they work a charm. They just are great. And there were some folks, I believe it, and it seems like there's variations on a theme on this particular floppy emulator, but they're not expensive at all. And there were some folks trying to get it to work on a PDP-11. With the PDP-11, the RQDX3, I believe, is the controller card. I've actually got one of those controller cards for my PDP, and I thought about trying to do this myself. You just have to build a custom cable, then hook it up to one of these, and you could actually have floppy emulation in that world, too. I don't know if they had to mess with the firmware or if the standard formats were workable for that. But, I mean, you slap this into something like an old 386, 486 machine, I think it would work great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's always sort of hovered just a little under my threshold for priorities to acquire.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, what do we got next? Man, we've got some great stuff this show. Steve, what do you want to talk about with ASCII art?
Well, that was,
or its ancestry thereof.
Yeah, that this popped up as I was looking for some information to talk about for the show. My first exposure to computers was in college on a small mainframe, the IBM 1130, and that had a line printer, which is text only. But people figured out how to use that to make banner type things, like Print Shop did years later, and they figured out how to make art with it or pictures. One of the classic ones was a picture of Snoopy on his doghouse, and many other things. And so this article in the online version of The Atlantic is called The Lost Ancestors of ASCII Art. It was posted in January of this year, and the subheading says, people make art with any technology. So they go on starting to talk about ASCII art that's still around from what's been archived from BBSs and stuff like that. But they go back to, he points out that people have been doing things like this with typewriters as far back as the 1890s.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, and people were apparently criticizing it at that time that it was a waste of time and so on. But they have some pictures on this website that's linked here, shows how they use typewriters to make like a picture of Christopher Columbus and some other, looks like a butterfly here. And some of the things they did involved double typing characters so that you had things overlapping themselves to create other characters. It's just interesting how people did that. And there's even some old, it would almost considered a type of programming, lists of how you could type things with your keyboard on a typewriter to come up with the picture that is shown there.
Oh, it's like a cross stitch or something.
Almost
or,
like a cross stitch, yes.
That is really interesting.
And then they go down to saying how they point out some basic programs that took the similar method and just have data statements that let you use the program in BASIC to create a picture using text characters on the screen. Just found it interesting.
It was beautiful stuff. I mean, I could see getting four-fifths of the way through it and then typing an X right in the middle of your picture by accident, you know, going and beating your head against the wall. But this is amazing. I'm looking at some of these things that were created with a typewriter.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's interesting how the typewriter, of course, gives you really quite fine control. You know, you can loosen the paper and angle it a little bit and move it just up and down a little. So some of that is really quite impressive.
Yes.
If you had a manual typewriter, you could probably vary the intensity of the stroke also.
Yes, indeed.
Wow. This is great. People should go look at this site. We'll have a link in the show notes. Yeah, do you guys remember the one of Spock?
Yes.
That was a famous one that back in the old computer ASCII art days, we'd always print that one out.
Yeah, we used to have some ASCII art hanging up in the old computer room back where I first worked, and they were cleaning it out one day, and they were we just took it all down, folded it up, threw it in the bin. I don't know, 25 years, 2020 hindsight. I wish I'd kept a few of those. they were done on the old Data 100 line printers. We had lots of fun finding those and getting them onto the mainframe and down to the printer. Reminiscing.
I had a couple of banners that I wish I'd have kept from the old middle school. We had to turn in our card batches, and a couple of days later we'd get our output from the huge monster mainframe downtown. And we had some pretty cool banners. Yeah, it'd be fun to have some of that stuff. Well, I'll go on the internet and I'll look it up. I'm sure there'll be some images out there. Next best thing, right?
Right.
Speaking of which, I came across, and this was from the CC Tech mailing list, a video on YouTube. It's actually a pretty recent video about a gentleman was showing some of the infrastructure that he had rescued and was actually firing up from the old CompuServe days. They apparently ran CompuServe on DEC PDP-10 computers, and then DEC had the nerve, the gall, to discontinue the PDP-10. And when they did, PDP-10 clones came about. There are a couple of them that I'm aware of that were workalikes for the PDP-10. And CompuServe switched over to those. And he shows in this video one of those systems booting up, how it's wired to the SCSI drives, how you had to go through the console and get all this stuff to fire up. It's fascinating to me because I had a CompuServe account back in the day, and now I'm actually getting to see how some of that back-end stuff serviced the CompuServe account way back when. So it's a good video. It'll be up in our show notes, and I am always happy when folks are able to get some of this equipment and preserve it and fire it up and show everybody else how it worked, because that's stuff that we've now captured for posterity.
He doesn't have that with the with CompuServe like software on it, does he?
That I don't know.
That would be especially cool if you could actually see the back end of the software that ran the system.
So it sounds like CompuServe Yes, in a sense, he kind of does, because it sounds like CompuServe took the operating system and tweaked it for their own purposes. But the applications that serve the external world, he doesn't speak to that in this video, so I don't know.
Okay.
But you're right, that would be really cool. That would be like when they rescued the Quantum Link software for Commodore and set up a Quantum Link service. Quantum Link was a predecessor to AOL,
yes.
Same players. And these folks painstakingly resurrected that stuff, and you could actually connect your Commodore to it again.
Oh, cool.
On the anniversary of Quantum Link. So.
And with CompuServe, the fact that it ran on the PDP-10, that had something to do with why they had those odd usernames, 10420,362.
Oh, interesting.
It had to do with apparently the way that the PDP-10 did accounts.
Manage the accounts. They do look like PDP accounts, now that you mention it. Huh. That's awesome. Anyway, fun video. Learn it, live it, love it. Paul, so spacecraft, we forget how to talk to our own creations. Aren't there shades of V'ger here when you think about it?
I think it's so. This is only. I mean, this is just sort of a brief note. It's something that just popped up. I don't know, somehow on my radar. I think again through the CC talk list, people should consider subscribing to that. But so we have there's a space exploration craft that was sent off in 1978, and it was it sort of went off, and I think it was supposed to explore the sun or something. And at a certain point, it was rerouted in order to have it go encounter a comet that it had an opportunity to come into contact with. And then it's called the I think it was originally called the ISEE-3, in under its new mission, it was called the ICE, and they stand for something. International Sun Earth Explorer and the International Cometary Explorer. But anyway, when it went, it found a comet. It did what it was supposed to do, and then it was just kind of forgotten about. And it's about to come back. I think in a couple of months, back sort of pretty close to Earth, and it turns out that NASA has in the last few years has gotten rid of all the stuff that they could have used to get into contact with it, so they can't talk to this thing when it comes through, and apparently it would be too expensive to sort of rebuild the stuff it would take to communicate with it. So it's a sad tale, but it is kind of related to this, the vanishing and the usefulness of the old technology sort of made explicit.
So it's almost like having a language that's no longer spoken that we cannot communicate because it doesn't have the current language.
Essentially, yeah. I think they don't have the capability to broadcast properly for it to pick up the signal. I think is what the problem is, that they sort of took down that facility, thinking it was no longer needed. And maybe it isn't any longer needed. The question is whether it would have been worth it to talk to this one little satellite.
It is kind of sad. It's going to zip by Earth, and it's going to say something like, V'ger seeks the creator.
Yes.
and we're not going to have any way to respond. And, yeah, so, they were talking about people starting up efforts to figure out how can we talk to this thing. Can we get the ham radio operators involved? Do they have the radio equipment? Would they know the right protocols to talk to it? And I think people are feeling that same thing that you're feeling, Paul, that it's, boy, wouldn't it be nice if we could just talk to this thing? It's almost becoming some people's mission.
Mm-hmm. And the crazy thing is, it's 1978 is what we're talking about. This thing was launched. It's really not that long ago.
No.
And it's completely, it's no longer possible to talk to it.
We created and sent it into space. Don't we have a moral responsibility to maintain contact?
Exactly. Especially when it tries to send us a message that about having to save the humpback whales.
Right.
Mom, I want to come home.
There's actually a fairly amusing Twitter fake account. I forget what it's called. It's something like the it's a fake account for the Mars rover. Or the Mars lander. I'll find it and I'll put a link in the show notes. But it sort of takes current. What is the name of that the one that just went up there? Curiosity or something, right?
Yes, yeah, Curiosity.
You know, so it's sort of like a snarky take on all the things that the actual explorer is doing.
Yep, but another day of red rocks.
Yeah, more or less.
Well, so we may not be able to do anything about that, but we can definitely do something to help our friends, our colleagues at the TNMOC, which we've talked about before on the show and really love the stuff we do. So, Michael, tell us what we can do to help those guys.
Well, again, I was just out there having a bit of a browse, and I decided to go and have a look at the webpage for the National Museum of Computing over in the UK, and went on to their support page just to see how things are going. And I just wanted to bring to people's attention that although the National Museum of Computing isn't funded directly by the British government, there is a donor matching funding pledge that's out there at the moment. So for any of our UK listeners, if you're looking for something to do with some spare pounds in your pocket, I'd recommend popping over to the Make a Donation page. And your donation, if it's meets some very basic guidelines, or basically be matched. So if you've got a spare £20, someone else will pop in an extra £20 along with that, and the National Museum of Computing will be that little bit better off. But it got me thinking that this is something that I would really like to see if I ever make it over to that side of the world. And it also reminded me that one of my favorite computers, the other Colossus, is over there as well, and the Colossus was a very important part of computing history. One of the first electronic computers built during the Second World War, and only in the last not even 10 years, a lot of its information has basically been declassified by the government. And there's a very good book out there, Colossus, The Secrets of Bletchley Park's Code-Breaking Computer. So if you're after some really retro computing history, I highly recommend this book. I'll put a link to it in the show notes. This book, very good series of essays on the code-breaking efforts and the use of the Colossus back in the day.
Excellent.
And that rebuild of Colossus was just so historically important. That, you know, again, we just love those folks. And yes, I would say, I would even go so far to say, if they'll accept it, even if you're not in the UK, but you are a person that's interested in computing history and the things that they're doing to preserve it, you know, consider maybe supporting them anyhow.
Well, there is details for our online donations, and including via PayPal. So I think I might just pop on over there and make my own donation.
Yeah, they're a great group of folks, and the website really interesting to go take a look at. Did you find it that way when you were over there?
I found it very interesting. I love the way they've laid it out for the. The various projects with the Colossus Gallery, Women in Computing. My favourite one is the PC Gallery. They've titled like, "Oh, look, kids! I used to use one of those." whole series of old computers. There's a strong showing of the British computing effort of the day, but there's a lot of machines there that us foreigners will be familiar with as well.
Excellent.
There's even a section there of before computers, so yeah, reminds me of my first job before I fell into the world of computers. My first job actually was as a calculator. Doing policy variations and adjustments in an insurance company. So my job was basically to get the folders of tables and books out and do all the mathematical calculations using the information supplied by actuaries to make the adjustments to people's policies, and then I gave that to someone else to double check. We had computers, but that was really just as a store or a repository of the information in the database. All of the adjustments had to be done manually, so you know, I had my effectively a ledger for my calculations, and just down there with pen, paper, and a calculator for some of the longer calculations. But yeah, my first job, I was a calculator.
Yeah, that's a job that doesn't exist anymore.
I don't miss it.
It must have been painstaking work.
Yeah, it was. You needed to have an eye for detail and you know, do remember the different formulas, or at least where to get the references for them. But no, it was something different to be doing out of university and before I started working for a computer retailer back in, we're talking about 81 through to about 83. So, yeah, that's a bit of a while ago now.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You come into your office, grab a cup of coffee.
Morning, Fred.
And a Xerox machine presents your morning mail on a screen.
What's the mail this morning? This one looks interesting. Let's take a look at this. I'm going to need a couple of copies of this.
Push a button, and the words and images you see on the screen appear on paper.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Fred. You know, Fred, I think everybody on the routing list should see this.
Push another button, and the information is sent electronically to similar units around the corner or around the world. This is an experimental office system. It's in use now at the Xerox Research Center in Palo Alto, California. Soon, Xerox systems like this will help you manage your most precious resource, information.
Anything else? Flowers. Well, what flowers? My anniversary. I forgot.
Well, so I don't have a smooth segue here, so I'll make a jagged one. I'm going to talk about Model M keyboards, one of the most beloved keyboards, I think, in history. The buckling spring Model M IBM keyboard has a sound and a style that just feels like the PC era. So people love them. And there's still a couple of places where you can buy buckling spring keyboards. Unicomp springs to mind, if you'll pardon the pun. but if you want to refurbish your existing Model M keyboard and you want to see a consummate professional who does this kind of thing, then you could head over to phosphorglow.net, where you'll find a link to a YouTube video with a time lapse of a complete refurbishing of a Model M keyboard. And you can, if you want, have your Model M keyboard refurbished by this gentleman. There are prices and details over on his site. But you've got to watch this video. I don't know how many minutes or hours of work it represents, but he takes a Model M keyboard, completely strips it down to its wires, takes the parts that can be cleaned with soap and water and puts them into that kind of environment, takes the rest of it and cleans it up, dusts it off, adjusts things as necessary, drills some holes and puts in some screw settings so that then the keyboard can be reassembled and actually be in a little bit better shape than it was when he took it apart. And then when it's done, you've got ostensibly a, you know, either a factory refurbished, or if you want to consider it that way, a little bit better than factory refurbished Model M keyboard.
That is amazing what he's going through to do this here.
Oh, he really goes through the steps, and you can tell it's a labor of love going through this. Now, if you want your Model M refurbished, it's not going to be a lot less expensive than just going out and getting a new buckling spring keyboard from somebody like Unicomp. But it does preserve the old keyboard, right? It's like a refurbishing of a retro computing device. And I've got a Model M here, sitting here, that, boy, I'm really thinking about shooting it his way. So I just thought I'd point that out for folks to take a look at. And I found it really quite a commitment to this old style of keyboard. He's even built a couple of custom tool sort of apparatus to enable him to do this work on the old Model M's.
Yeah, this is way more complicated than just throwing the board into the dishwasher and seeing what that happens.
Yes.
Yeah, unfortunately, so is there a common sort of like mode of failure of these keyboards? I have exactly one. I'm hoping it does okay. I think it's working now, but it hadn't even occurred to me to try to fix it. What is it that goes wrong?
I don't know.
Okay.
You guys know?
Well, if you look on the website, it does show some pictures of other keyboards that are in need of cleaning, and they just look terrible. I mean, they're cosmetically awful. Now, whether the cosmetic awfulness translates to functional awfulness or not, I don't know. But these keyboards are ones that clearly have undergone tremendous wear and tear, and they've been in dirty environments. Maybe they were in a garage that had auto parts they were ordering. I don't know. But they look awful, and what he's ending up with is something that's like in mint condition.
My Model M keyboard, well, technically I've got a couple, but one of them's a little bit different style because it came out of the IBM Portable, the 5155, so it looks a little different. The other is an authentic Model M. It's in about the condition that Dr. Steve just described. It looks like somebody had run over it with a car a couple of times and maybe left it outside in the rain, and it did wind up having a functional effect on it somehow, and I don't know. I've had it open. I've tried to look for where the problem is, but when you press on the keys, sometimes you get double keys. Sometimes you don't get the key at all. The problem seems electrical, but it's difficult to figure out what about the way the keyboard was abused could be causing that problem. So, but I'm pretty sure this guy could figure it out.
Interesting. Yeah, I saw some discussion about how they were assembled. I think this is what you were mentioning with putting in the screw, the screw receptacles or whatever, that some of these screws went straight into the plastic. So it becomes kind of hard to reassemble after you've taken them apart.
Right. That was on the CC Talk also, right? That discussion that was on there. You're right. People should subscribe to that. Lots of great stuff that goes by on there. And CC Talk is... Well, there's CC Talk and CC Tech. If you're the type who would like more on-topic discussions, then you want the CC Tech. CC Talk occasionally goes off the rails on other topics, so besides vintage computing.
Yeah, it's like top posting and trimming.
Exactly, that kind of thing. So I subscribe to the CC Tech, and it is great information. Anyway, on to this episode's retro computing gift idea. It's been a long time since we had some clothing. So, and if people haven't seen this particular t-shirt or this sign and you're in computing, then where have you been? There are 10 types of people in the world: those who understand binary and those who don't.
Boom, boom.
You get it? You get it? Ba-dum-bum. Anybody who knows binary will look at that shirt and have a chuckle. Anybody who doesn't know binary will just look at you with a glazed look, and then you know you need to revoke their geek card.
If they're probably waiting for you to walk past so that they can see the rest on the back.
That's true. So one of these t-shirts, $20 at Amazon, and I'm sure there's other places you can get them, but that's one choice. So that's my gift idea of the episode. And I don't actually have one. So I got to go get one. And that's it. So everybody could buy me one. As Carrington always says, you know, this, we call it the retro computing gift idea, but really it's the retro computing thing you can give to me.
Yes.
Idea.
Exactly.
I got to do that because Carrington's not here. I should mention, I never even mentioned this. Carrington, how quickly we forget ye.
Who?
But
I'm sure our listeners would have noticed his absence.
Carrington is AWOL again, but it's just a schedule conflict. He said it had nothing at all to do with my garlic breath and that he would be back next episode. So we're going to hold him to it.
He's over at Sochi representing Canada.
He must be, yes. As we joked, he must be over there curling. That's what I always tell him. You're going curling, eh? So, on to other stuff you can buy. What have you got for us, Paul?
Well, this I'm not sure that I'm encouraging buying this, but it's a sort of an interesting thing that's been on eBay. This is an S100 computer that ran the Capital RCPM BBS in Chicago? It says original Raleigh, so maybe it's in Raleigh. at any rate, it's basically a machine that ran an early bulletin board system that, you know, handled, I think, multiple lines, and it's basically just the machine and the software, and it's something that really kind of belongs in a museum or you know, at least archived in some way. So part of what brought it to my attention again, I guess, is that there was a little bit of chatter about it on Twitter. People were thinking that maybe it might be something to sort of like jointly purchase or something, if the person who's selling it can't be convinced to donate it, which may well be the case. So it's been listed for a while. I think I probably first saw this listing, it might have been almost a year ago. So it's there. It's being sold for $31.50 about US dollars, which is not a huge amount, but it's more than anyone has been able to justify so far. So it's sitting there, and it would be a shame if it got purchased and hidden away, because it really it looks like it is basically the complete, you know, bulletin board system with all the discs and everything from that time. So anyway, I was just sort of bringing it up. I if you buy it, do archive it, I guess is my message.
Yeah, so the software that Ward Christensen wrote, is that what this is? Is it that same original BBS software that they talked about on the BBS documentary and that, I wonder?
It's probably a later revision of it, because this one ran between 1984 to 88. So it's not the oldest one from 76, 77, whenever it was that the original Chicago one started, but it's probably a descendant of it.
It just kind of fooled me here because it's got the quad 8-inch discs, and holy cow, that seems old.
Well, most of the original CPM software was on 8-inch floppy disks. They had to retrofit it to make it work on the 5 1/4-inch disks for the various 8-bit micros that came later.
It does say somewhere that it's the BBS software was called CBBS, so it's a descendant, of the original BBS software.
And they do mention it is a descendant of what Ward Christensen and Randy Seuss had done with the. They've got that down here a little bit later in the auction description. Wow, and just in terms of what it comes with, it's a pretty impressively complete system.
Yeah, I think it actually is, it's not priced crazily. It's the kind of thing that you would hope someone would donate, but to some place where the public can kind of see it. But I guess the main thing is that it's not it's not an MSI. It's not a, you know, it's not a specific, you know, model. It was sort of assembled, you know, sort of by hand, I think, you know, out of parts. But it looks like it has a lot of, you know, a lot of peripheral boards in it, and, you know, just even apart from the BBS heritage, it's pretty close to worth what is being asked, I think.
Yeah, it's got some California Computer Systems boards in it. I used to work at a retail store that sold that equipment.
And I'm amazed, if I'm reading this correctly, that these 8-inch floppy disks carried 70K per disk.
Wow, don't spend that all in one place.
Doesn't sound like a whole lot for 8 inches, but since this you get 70 to 140K on the 5 1/4-inch disks that came later.
Yep,
Yeah, and in fact, so of course now switching back to Apple II mode, you could, although I don't think they were very common, get an 8-inch disc for an Apple II specifically because you could store more on it. You know, the point would be that it actually could hold more than the 5 1/4 disc.
Yeah, I think that just has to do with what revision of it you got, and because obviously later 5 1/4 inch floppies went to as much as 1.4 megs. On the IBM system. So, you know, clearly with greater technology, you could get greater speed, concentration of the bits on the disk.
This is pretty, though. I'm scrolling my way down through this auction. Wow, that quad 8-inch floppy drive thing looks like it should be in a movie.
Yeah. And, wow, this capacitor, man.
Yeah!
It's big.
Yeah, and everything looks so clean.
Looks like it's like 3 inches across in diameter, that capacitor that's on there.
Yeah, don't walk up and just grab that.
Well, if touch it, you'll fly.
I think so.
Very nice. Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens with this. There is a make offer button. So if somebody was close to this price but couldn't quite get there, then maybe clicking the make offer would be an alternative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you're right, by the way, the pictures just keep going on. So even if you're not in the actual market, it's a neat auction to look at just for the pictures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hope those get preserved somewhere. Maybe
maybe I should just go do that now.
Well, yeah. I mean, the S100 Computers site has an area for photos of various S100 computer boards and computer chassis and that kind of thing. If the person who did this eBay auction was amenable to it, it would be nice to have those photos stuck over there. But any of it, very cool, Paul. Thank you. Michael, what have you got for us on eBay?
Well, I thought I'd just introduce the world to a computer that was down here in Australia, the Dick Smith VZ200 and the VZ300. Here on this listing is really the start of your collection. It includes two VZ300s and two VZ200s, power supplies, manuals, tapes, and cartridges. So if you're after something a bit on the different side, have a look at these. Now, it uses a external power supply, so even over in your side of the world at 110 volts, you can get the appropriate power supply and tip and run these little 9-volt machines.
Now, Dick Smith has had a reputation making clones of other computers. When I look at the screenshots, is this a clone of a VIC-20 or Commodore 64?
It's not a clone. This one's actually a rebadge of the VTech Laser. I believe that they were created in Taiwan, and various companies bought effectively the naming and distribution rights to various parts of the planet. So down here in Australia and New Zealand, Dick Smith picked it up, and they were selling it as the VZ200, and then later on as the VZ300. So,
But does it work like some other computer, that software from that other computer would work? Because I know there's a Dick Smith model that is a rebadge of a VTech Laser 3000, which was the Apple II. I was just wondering if this was a Commodore type one. I'm not enough familiar with the graphics, but the screenshot reminds me of that.
I believe this one's a Z80 based machine.
Okay.
As fate would have it, I've just recently purchased one myself, just the VZ200, so I'm waiting for that to arrive, and I'll give everyone a bit of an update later on. But it's a Z80 processor in the 200.
Interesting.
The one I've got, I think, is only a 4K ROM. Even by my standards of machines, that's a pretty small one. But just something different from computers that are outside of what most people would be familiar with.
Yes, it's excellent. So Dick Smith is or was a retailer.
A retailer. Originally, He started off very much like a Tandy store. So you had your retail side, components, kits, all the bits and pieces that you would need for doing electronics and electrical work. So Dick Smith sold the company along with the name. So Dick Smith now no longer has anything to do with Dick Smith. But, yeah, he's a bit of an entrepreneur here in Australia. He's dabbled in magazines, the Australian Geographic magazine. He's now promoting foods and food products that are made in Australia, sort of trying to get people to buy Australian. I'm sure there's similar campaigns in other parts of the world, but he's worked with our CASA, our Commonwealth Airline or Aeronautics body, and some people might even know him for being trying to fly around the world in a helicopter. So he's a bit of an adventurer, entrepreneur, very nice guy. I've met him a few occasions at functions. So it's just sort of an interesting historical tidbit. These computers, Dick Smith also did a System 80, which I believe was a TRS-80 Model 1 clone as well. A lot of that happened back in the days.
And that's one of the ones that, Terry Stewart has talked about on his video blog, the Dick Smith Model 80.
Yeah, the System 80 was an interesting
System
machine.
System 80, I mean.
Yeah, that almost became the first computer I used. A friend of mine bought the System 80, but at that stage I wasn't that interested in computers. He had trouble with the TV set that he was setting up to use as a monitor, so we all lost interest very quickly while he was saying, oh, I'll show it to you working next time. So we just then went off, and I think we were over at his place just playing some D&D back then. So if that demo had worked out a bit differently, maybe I'd be a TRS-80, System 80 fan rather than later on falling into the evil clutches of the Apple Empire.
That's awesome. What do you think that you will have received it, maybe had a chance to play with it by the next podcast?
Well, I was looking at my emails this morning, and the seller says that he's already shipped it. So it's been interesting seeing it's the weekend, so I'm not quite sure that... I suppose Australia Post does operate on a Saturday morning, so maybe it is already on its way. So I'll at least let you guys know how it works. It's supposed to be operational. I just have to supply my own external power supply. So looking forward to hooking it up and giving it a go.
Yeah, the way eBay tends to notify you about shipping usually just means they printed the label. So it may not actually be in the mail yet.
We can live in hope.
Cool, though. That is awesome. Dr. Steve, what have you got for us?
Well, in honor of the Olympics and my own Apple II bias, I wanted to find a Russian Apple II on eBay, and there's one called the Agat, A-G-A-T, that I found a picture of on the Vintage Computer Forum, but I couldn't find that on eBay. I did find a Province 82 Bulgarian Apple II clone on eBay, and that one is going for currently like about $459. Buy it.
This thing looks excellent.
Yeah.
It is. It is. It's very sort of like homemade almost looking.
Yeah. I love this.
And it interests me, you know, when I'm thinking about the Apple IIs that were the clones that were made outside the U.S., even the ones that Apple did that had other languages in there, is that I haven't seen enough with them to know exactly how you switched between the two different character sets, because this has got the Cyrillic alphabet type characters on it, and certainly there must be some way of going between Roman characters, English, to the other character set to display things. But it just would be cool to have one and you know, see how the thing works. what's the differences between this and a standard?
Yeah, yeah. No, I was sort of aware of the existence of the Pravats, and there were a few of them. The name was attached to a number of different clones, which for a little while were Apple II clones, but then they sort of went off to. I think they then were PC clones after that. But and I think the Pravats 82 is the first one, the first Apple II clone one.
Presumably from 82.
Yeah, right. I think so. If you search on eBay, there are a few others. And the names are very confusing. So there's the 82, and then the 8M, and the 8E, and the 8A in this order, and then the 8D. So, but yeah, it's. I've always kind of wanted to get a hold of one, but I've never really been that interested in getting one shipped from Bulgaria.
Yes.
Well, I'll also point out, again, on this one, there's the make offer. So, you know, you could pay more, but why? Nice. Well, you guys, you know, you guys are rock stars. My thing is boring in comparison. But what I have, though, is something that interests me, not because it's a retro computing device, but how it would interface with. It is one of the AT&T standard touch-tone telephones. And they say on the auction that this is brand new. I can imagine myself taking this touch-tone phone, dialing up a BBS, and putting the handset into the cradle of an acoustic coupler and, you know, sticking my ear up to it and listening to the melodic tones of 300 baud as they ring through the thing, and then typing surely but slowly to the remote system. And I've wanted one of these phones for a long time because with the advent of VoIP and other people getting interested in the retro computing hobby, a couple of BBSs have popped back up that you can dial on a standard telephone line, not just the Telnet BBS, but where there's actually a phone line that you could dial. And I've also thought about trying to set up some sort of connector between the computer and POTS, your plain old telephone system line, so that I could run my own BBS inside my own PBX. Have you guys ever heard of Asterix? It is a Linux distribution that is a phone system central office. It's a PBX. And if you have the right equipment, you can connect between Asterix and a standard telephone, meaning you could have your own internal extensions and then dial 9 to get out or whatever and connect out to the world telephone system. So if you wanted to simulate the BBS experience, you could have your own little telephone exchange. And the only thing that I'm missing to be able to do that is the card or the connection on the computer that connects it to a standard telephone line. But everything else is just open source. You can get one of these PBX softwares and run it and play around with it. It works just great.
Well, you know, one of the vintage memories that those of us who use BBS has that I have not found audio for on the internet is the sound of a lower speed modem dialing and connecting to a BBS. I've heard the one that has the extra tones that you hear when you're dialing up to something that's running at 28K or 56K. It's got a lot of extra sounds, but I remember that it used to dial, you'd hear the tone, it had a little extra buzz, and then it was connected. And there's no audio of the old connection sounds that I can find anywhere on the internet. It's probably out there, I just haven't found it yet.
Like an old 110 or an old 300?
110, 300, maybe even 1200, you know. It didn't sound the same with the extra signal noises that you had on the high-speed ones, because the high-speed ones had to do some compression and error correction and stuff like that that the other ones didn't have.
And I think they had line training, too. They do the little ping-pong frequency sweeps to figure out the capability of the line.
So, yeah, but I think that's on the newer ones, where it's got the frequency
right.
sweep thing. The old ones didn't have that.
Right. They didn't have all that ping-pong
yes,
kind
yes.
of stuff.
What I recall is basically just a solid tone. Basically, it's just like, you know, It seems like we should be able to make recordings, but it's true that any time I've ever looked for a modem sound, it's always like a 56.6 connection sound.
Well, you've got one of the CX20s, right, Paul? Is yours working?
Well, I don't know. The iPhone doesn't fit. That's the thing actually that I would want one of these phones for. I have exactly one of this form factor specifically, so I can put it in those couplers. I haven't tried it out. I have it's on it's somewhere, it's fourth or fifth on the project list. But I hope to soon, and I'll record the audio.
Is that line item or pages?
It might be pages.
I want one of these phones. And right now, this seems like a decent deal if it really is brand new, like they're saying, and it's $12 with $12 shipping. Then does that seem like a good deal?
If it's a working phone, that's it's probably reasonable. I actually have a couple of phones like this sitting around my house, but I don't know if they still work. I don't have regular telephone service anymore. We've dropped it for just using our cell phones, so I have nothing to run them on at all either.
Gotcha.
Can buy replica phones, Amazon and other dealers as well. That are in that style, and also older styles, including the old wall phones as well. But that's not too bad a price.
For something like this, you might... The one that I got, I think I got it for like $5 or something like that, because I just went to a recycler. I was there anyway, and they had these things sitting around. I got one and left one, but
if you're looking for something that's new, this one looks good,
as opposed to
buying something which is second hand, being out the back of the warehouse and then off to the recycler. If you're after something that's looking shop worn, that's a good way to get it. But this one's all bright and shiny and just waiting to be used.
And Earl, if you really want the more retro aspect, you got to get one of those standard desk phones that has the dial on it instead of the touch tones.
Rotary dials, yeah.
Yes. That might be a little much when I'm dialing up to try and simulate the BBS sort of thing.
I had one
when I was a kid, though. Those were great. You tick, 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 tick.
Yeah, except for when the numbers had zeros in them.
Right.
Actually, the thing that was neat, and I think I only discovered this from like reading books about the phone freaks of the day or whatever. But it turns out that all the rotary dial is doing is just like very quickly hanging up the phone. So you could actually dial by just almost like Morse coding the phone number in. If you just hung it up and rapidly 10 times, that would be a 0, and 2 would be a 2. And...
Right at the church we attended when I was young, they had a phone downstairs where they had like a daycare during the regular week, and they had a little lock stuck in the one circle on the dial phone, so they would prevent people from using it. But all you have to do would be just to flip the receiver and go click 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 click, and you could dial it by doing it that way.
Sorry, wrong number.
Yeah, 75% of the time that's what happens, yes.
That's right.
Lots of flashing, but that, wow, cool, that would actually work, huh? Man, you learn something new every day. All right, so I might bid on this phone. We'll see if somebody listening to the podcast doesn't bid first. Well, there's only a couple days, so I'll ask Carrington to drag his feet. All right, so that takes care of the normal business of the show, so we're into the parting shots, the closing discussions, the wrap-up, the round the table one more time, the cleanup, I can't think of any other metaphors, so...
Well, we've used up all our time now.
So, Paul, why don't you start?
Well, I don't have much to add here. I'm just sort of sifting through things, scanning some things, it's been pretty interesting. The problem with scanning stuff is that then you're tempted to read it, and that slows you down. But I recently got a pile of it was basically a pile of photocopies that someone had made. You know, so someone made an illegitimate copy of you know, some software, and then photocopied the manual. And then, you know, 20 years went by, and the photocopies are still there. And some of the manuals actually aren't out there scanned, as far as I can tell. So I've you know, run a couple of those, which is, it's, you know, it's kind of interesting to make them available. It's a little obnoxious that they're photocopies, but you know, at the same time, it's better than not having them at all. So anyway, not a whole lot going on other than that.
I love seeing the collection of stuff that you tweet about that you've scanned in this or that. That's always amazing how much stuff you've got.
Yeah, looking around, it's sort of absurd.
And a great service to archive that stuff.
I tell myself that, yes.
That's right. That's right. It's a labor of love. What about you, Michael?
Well, apart from the VZ200, which I'm waiting to arrive, another acquisition that arrived on Thursday was a box copy of the original PowerPoint by Forethought. This is before Microsoft bought it, so that completes my retro Mac office. So I've got a 512K Mac, and I now have Microsoft Word version 1, Multiplan 1.1, PowerPoint version 0, version 1, for want of a better word, by Forethought. For my database app, I'm using Helix, and for my project management, I'm using Apple Project. So that's the full suite running. I'll have that all up and running on a 512K Mac. At the moment, that's all floppy based driven. So I've got to image the Forethought, and I'll run that through Mini vMac on one of my desktops just to get everything going. And the next project on that is to get a working HD20 hard drive for the 512K Mac. I've got five HD20s that I've picked up from around the place, and I'm hoping that I can at least build a working one out of them. The HD20 was the precursor to the SCSI external drives for the early Macintoshes. It actually plugs into the floppy port on the back of the Mac, and then you just daisy chain your floppy external floppy drive off the HD20. So interesting little retro office project that I've got going at the moment. So
well, I do hope that you use the PowerPoint at your next presentation.
I shall use my PowerPoint for goodness. I shall not use it for evil.
That is awesome. A Mac 512, like, fully functional with all the goodies from back in the day.
Yeah, and I've got my old ImageWriter 1 printer that I bought with my Apple IIc, so I'll be using that for the output side. It'd be nice to track down one of the original Apple Writer laser printers or a laser printer from HP, just to completely go to the high-end office computer of the mid to late 80s.
Very cool. And what about you, Dr. Steve?
Well, I'm enjoying seeing some sales of my book on Amazon. I don't know exactly how it's selling, but usually when I take a look at it, the ranking is somewhere between 30,000th and 180,000th on the list.
And, woohoo!
Well, I guess what I find from looking at someone
who... That's a fairly wild fluctuation.
Well, and it's interesting because I had the impression that they updated the stats like once a day, but apparently, like, I refreshed the screen a couple hours ago and it was like 180,000, and I did it just now and it's like 52,000. But I'm just grateful that it continues to be selling enough that it shows up, with considering all the books Amazon sells, that it's showing up enough to be in their list at all. So it's, and someone who had a post someplace about what is Amazon's code, what does that mean? Apparently, if you have something that's selling, it's at like number 10,000 on the list, it's probably selling about 30 copies a week, and something that's 100,000 on the list is about one copy a week. So it's somewhere probably about 5 to 10 to 15 copies a week is going. So that seems good. So I'm enjoying just seeing those numbers. Eventually it's going to drop down, you know, low enough that it won't show up anymore. But for now, it's just kind of fun to see it's there. And in my spare time, when I'm not studying for a medical test that's coming up that I have to take, a couple years ago, I enjoy playing Minecraft. I made a larger-than-life-size Apple II in Minecraft that you could walk around inside of. I'm redoing that now as a four times size from what it was before. So the bigger size, you can put better detail on the thing.
And do you know if that Minecraft world would load up on the Raspberry Pi version?
If you can get it to run under Unix and have Java running, you just have to have Unix with Java. It's supposed to be all you need to make that run.
Huh. Because that would be, when you get that going, that would be fun to walk around in.
And I'm actually adding to it, it's going to be an Apple IIe, and I'm adding to it the Apple Modem 1200 that was kind of a flat white box that sat on the outside with a phone that looks just like the one you wanted to buy sitting on top of it. So that turns out to be, the typical Minecraft character is about two blocks tall, and a block is about considered to be a square meter. So this is, I'm doing it at the rate of four blocks per inch scale. So the phone is like, you know, it looks as big as a house almost.
Yeah, that's like when the first phones came out.
That's right.
They were that big, and then miniaturization, you know, finally got them smaller. It used to take five of us to just get the thing off of the handset.
Exactly. So what are you doing, Earl?
Me? What's going on? My ADD is showing the last couple months. I am just all over the place on projects. I'm doing electronics, and then I'm working on podcast stuff, and then I'm working on the retro computer stuff, and then I'm working on a modern thing that I'm doing is taking an interest again in 3D graphics. There's a game engine and game... It's primarily for games, but it doesn't have to be used for games. It's a game engine and development environment called Unity, and you can use it to develop. You bring in your 3D models and you animate them, and you can write scripting in JavaScript or in C#, and move things around and have lighting and cameras and all sorts of. It's a huge amount of fun to just poke around with it. So. But if I ever want to finish any one of these individual things, I need to just chain myself down to one project for a little bit of time and then actually get it done. But I'm having fun.
That's the important point. Have fun with it.
So I guess that does it for this episode of RCR. It's been fun, as always. You can find the show notes for all the RCR shows, including this one, at rcrpodcast.com. All the fun stuff that we talked about. I think we had a particularly fun episode with resources this time, so make sure to come over to rcrpodcast.com and check out the links. If you want to discuss, we're on the forums over at vintage-computer.com/VC forum. And while you're there, hang out on some of the other subforums because it's a great group of folks. You can follow RCR on Twitter at RCR Podcast. And we've recently been chastised by one of our alumni, David, that we haven't been doing a lot with our Twitter account lately. So David's right. We will actually pick up and get to tweeting some things of interest. If you'd like to send feedback, we always love to hear from you. feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a proud member of the Throwback Network. Lots of retro stuff there, not just retro computing, just retro in general. If you want to party like it's the 80s, the place you can do that is throwbacknetwork.net. And if you like us, please write a review on iTunes. And if you don't like us, send me an email and tell me why. We'll do a little tweaking, a little twisting, and a little payola, and we'll make you like us. And until next time,
retro compute!
Yeah.